I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Kids love stories about animals, whether it's about a very hungry caterpillar, Winnie the Pooh and his friends in the 100-acre wood, or a fantastic Mr. Fox. If you're a parent, there's a good chance your child has asked for a pet, whether it's a dog, a cat, a gerbil, a turtle, even a bearded dragon. Some research has found that caring for animals can make children more empathetic. Dogs can be trusted confidants for a young person and can help some children with autism deal with relationships. So today on Radio Times, the emotional, social, and physical benefits of pets for kids. And we have three guests who have joined us. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is James Serple. He's the Marie A. Moore Professor of Humane Ethics and Animal Welfare, also Director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society at the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He just told me a book he wrote 20 years ago called The Domestic Dog is being updated. And James Serple, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, happy to be back.
Also joining us and joining us by telephone is Megan Mueller. She's research professor at the Tufts University's Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine, also associate director at Tufts Institute for Human-Animal Interaction. Megan Mueller, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Gail Melson. She's Professor Emerita of Human Development and Family Studies at Purdue University. And she wrote a book called Why the Wild Things Are, Animals in the Lives of Children. Gail Melson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Happy to be here.
Let me begin with you, Megan. I was reading that your dog, Jet, walked you down the aisle when you got married. Does that tell us something about how you feel, not just about Jet, but about dogs and animals in general?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, like a lot of people, my dog is an important member of my family, so it seemed only right that he was there.
And to you, James Serple, were you, as a kid, we're going to be talking about children today, but as a kid, did you grow up with animals?
I was completely obsessed with animals. I filled the house full of frogs and snakes, much to my mother's horror, because they were always getting out of their various containers and traveling around the house and appearing unexpectedly. So, yes, I was.
You like the more reptilian
everything
animals?
I think I went through everything that I was allowed, from fish up to dogs.
And how about for you, Gail?
Well, I grew up with a small, was very much part of our family. And I think I never thought of her as an animal. I just thought of her as Trixie, yet another sibling, only very small and fur-covered.
Let me go back to you, Gail, because you wrote a book called Why the Wild Things Are. And I do want to sort of begin with stories. I mentioned a few in my introduction. Why are children, or have been children, been so attracted to animals? And you even found that there were prehistoric toys that were of animals. What should we make of this attraction, this connection?
Right. Well, I think that this is something that we all can tune into when we think about our own childhoods and when we look around us at not only our own society but at other societies as well, that there seems to be this fascination and attraction that children have with animals. Sometimes it's expressed, even can be as fear, but it's a strong emotion that children have. I think as social scientists and people involved in veterinary medicine, we're still trying to look at what the underlying basis of this is. And one theory, the biophilia hypothesis, suggests that, you know, human beings sort of evolved in a world of other living things, especially other animals. And so it's in our DNA, if you will, or in our brains, that we're attuned to life forms. And this attunement is something that can be expressed in many different ways depending upon the culture and the society that we're part of. In other words, it can be shaped in many different ways, but we kind of come into the world not having to be taught a fascination with the life around us.
Well, let me go back to you, James Serple, and we are focusing largely on children, or certainly families and animals and their pets. Not everyone likes that word. How do you see what this connection is. And children, I mean, I have a dog, and kids see the dog, and they run up to the dog and want to pet it and, you know, ask me all sorts of questions about it. What is that connection about, do you think?
It's a little unclear, but as Gail pointed out, there is some evidence now for a sort of biological basis for this attraction. So we know, for example, that there are tiny areas of the brain that light up when people look at images of animals, and they don't light up when they look at other kinds of images, like images of trains or people or whatever. So it looks like there might even be a tiny part of the brain that's exclusively dedicated. We know that even very young children, and I'm talking here about children in the range of sort of 4 months to 14 months, if you offer them video images of different things moving, different animated objects, they focus much more preferentially on the animals. And so again, it looks like there's something in there, something inbuilt, that makes animals intrinsically interesting, something that grabs our attention. Of course, as Gail said, that attention might lead to fear in some cases, or phobias, or it might lead to attraction, and that depends a lot on the individual and the culture and all the rest of it.
Indeed, and I do want to pick up on that. Megan, going to you, I wonder also within families, if there is a dog or a cat, whether the children in the family sort of identify in many ways with that child with that animal, because in certain ways, like them, they're kind of dependent on the adults in the family.
Right, absolutely. Animals can be a really important part of the family system, and I think that's what we're seeing, is that it's really part of this whole family dynamic. It's not just the child, individual child and the animal. The animal is often part of the whole family dynamic. And what we're beginning to look at is really what these relationships look like for kids and their animals, that it's the quality of the relationship and how the child might emotionally process that relationship that can be linked to different kinds of outcomes. And you're right that children have a very special relationship with animals because they connect with them on many different levels, and that sort of depends on what the family system looks like. And we're beginning to learn more about how complex that is, and that's what makes it such a fun area to study.
Well, let me follow up on that. Megan, I'll go back to you, but Gail and James, I'd like to get a response as well. There has been some research that looks at empathy and children and caring for pets. Megan, can you weigh in on that? And we'll hear from our other guests as well. Is there a connection there?
Sure. I think there's some increasingly compelling evidence that of this social relationship element that happens when we're talking about animals and children. And one of the important things that we learn as humans is how to interact with other human beings, and part of that is this idea of reciprocity, that I can understand that my perspective might be different than yours and that you have different needs than I do. And it's an interesting hypothesis that by interacting with animals, children are able to develop these empathy behaviors, these perspective-taking behaviors. And I think that's an area of research that is really going to expand in the future, because it's a very compelling hypothesis.
Indeed it is. James Herpel, do you have a theory on this? Or?
Yeah, I mean, there's one notion is, and it's an idea that's been around for a long time among parents, is that taking responsibility for an animal's care during childhood entrains you to become a more responsible adult and might entrain you to become a better parent. And some of these effects of early childhood pet ownership, like empathy, social perspective taking, or pro-social behavior in general, could be viewed as skills that are very useful for being a parent, for caring for your own infants later on in life. So I don't think we can necessarily discount the idea that one reason for allowing children to engage in these types of early relationships with animals may actually be useful to them later on in life.
Gail, for you, taking both what Megan and what Jim just said, can we say that having pets in the family is a good thing for children, that people should really think about this seriously?
Well, you know, I think like anything in the life of children and families, we always have to think about potential. And so I would underscore the idea of potential. Yes, potentially, an animal can be a wonderful way in which a child can experience the idea that there are creatures very different from them with very different needs. And to understand that, they need to, I like to think of it, is step out of their own shoes and into the paws of another creature. So that fundamental exercise in perspective taking and understanding the world from another person's point of view is a foundation for empathy, a foundation for social a sensitivity to others that, of course, children need in childhood and during adulthood. And as James said, it's an integral part of being a good parent. But I want to come back to potential because sure. The family system, and we're talking about parents and caregivers and older siblings and other people in the family, really, I think, shape the quality of any relationship that the child is going to have. So unfortunately, we also have research on issues related to animal abuse, and we know that that is connected to child abuse, to abuse of other people in a family, that children unfortunately can learn lessons that are bring harm to animals in the context of a very dysfunctional, destructive family system. So that's why it's a potential, I think, that can be very beneficial for children, but it's very much shaped by the human family and the human society that the child is in.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Jane? We're almost up in about a minute before our break here, but I mean, this is such an important point, and there is a connection, as I understand, between child abuse and animal abuse.
Certainly, there's abundant evidence for a connection there. Gail is saying is terribly important. You know, we shouldn't automatically assume that every child's going to benefit from a pet or every pet's going to benefit from being in that particular household, that particular family. And we need to consider each family and each child individually from that point of view.
Indeed. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about animals and children. And again, our guest, James Serpel, he's director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society. That's at the Penn Vet School here in Philadelphia. Gail Melson, professor emerita of human development and family studies at Purdue University, wrote a book called Why the Wild Things Are, Animals in the Lives of Children. Also with us, Megan Mueller, and she is a research assistant professor at Tufts University's Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine. Also Associate Director of Tufts Institute for Human-Animal Interaction. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about several things, why children are so drawn to animals, and a bit about the emotional, social, and physical benefits of pets in children's lives. Although, as we just said, a pet is not a prescription for every family. And again, you can send us a comment at radiotimes@whyy.org. Megan, I want to pick up on something and go back to you about talking in a more sort of positive light about the kind of nonverbal cues that children can learn when living with or probably taking care of pets. I mean, we as humans, we talk to each other all the time. Animals obviously don't do that, but there's lots of communication that is going on. Can you speak to that?
Sure. I think that's a really important component of understanding these relationships. I think there's a lot of nonverbal behavior and a lot of ways that we communicate with animals in a nonverbal way. And for companion animals in the home, and then we often see this with horses as well, they're very responsive to our physical behavior. And when we're talking about children who are learning how to regulate their physical body and space, it can interacting with an animal can provide some good feedback from them about what is behavior that will encourage a positive interaction and what behavior might not encourage a positive interaction. And I think dogs in particular are an interesting case because they have a long history of coevolution with humans, and they are in particular very good at interacting with us and us and looking at our body language and really incorporating that into how that relationship looks.
And Jim, we often think of dogs as, you know, as our confidants. They don't judge us. And sometimes I wonder, are they judging us?
That's a good question. They don't.
Are they saying, oh, my God, here she is unloading on me again, right?
Right. I don't know. I think we project an enormous amount onto them. That's the thing. And they're very good at as being projectors, if you like. Or projector screens.
Yes, exactly.
And reflecting back at us stuff we want to believe about them.
Right, very Rogerian in terms
of
being our little canine therapist. Gail, let me go back to you, and this is a more practical question. And in my introduction, I included, you know, many children want to have an animal in their life, and then their parents say, okay, and they say to the child, now you're going to walk the dog and you're going to feed them and you're going to do all the responsibilities.
Right.
And
right.
It lasts for about a week, and then lo and behold, the parents are kind of taking care of everything. Are there things that parents can do to introduce an animal into the family that really does engage the children in terms of these responsibilities?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing because in surveys with parents, they do mention the idea of teaching responsibility, and that came up earlier in a comment that James made. We looked at some national survey data in one study that were very fine-grained information about what people did. It's called activity records, you know, how you spend your time in a 24-hour period. And we found that families that had animals in the home, that had pets, the primary and overwhelming caregiver was the mother. So it turned out to be quite, as you said, that despite best intentions, the responsibility really did devolve on the parents and most particularly the mother. And I think this notion of teaching responsibility is a good one, but I would probably, if I were talking to parents thinking about that and their child, I would say, let's scale back our expectations. Children can learn a lot from parental modeling. That tends to be a very powerful tool. So watching the responsive and appropriate caregiving that a parent gives to an animal can in itself, even if the child is not taking sole responsibility, be a very good lesson. Accompanying a parent, helping a parent by, for example, bringing the dog food over and then the parent measuring it out the appropriate amount, so kind of cooperative caregiving can be a very good bridge. But it's ultimately, I think parents, I would say, ought to think about bringing an animal, a dog or any other animal, into a family, much as bringing a sibling. When we say to a child, guess what, you're going to have a baby brother or sister, we imagine all kinds of very good things that that child will experience in a sibling relationship. But we know that We, the humans, are the responsible. We're the caregivers. We're the ones who need to take charge. And I think much in the same way, the animal is ultimately the adult responsibility.
Jim, do you want to weigh in on that?
No, except to agree thoroughly and speaking from bitter experience. You know, I remember my kids when they wanted me to get a dog for the first time. They wrote a kind of declaration of independence. You know, it was multiple clauses saying we will do this, we will do that, and you know, it was a worthless document because
you didn't
never
tack
did.
It up on the refrigerator. And
it
say,
did actually for a while, but I don't know. It gradually disappeared.
Well, it's funny. You and I were talking before the show began, you know, about how people think of animals in their families as children. And I mean, I have seen dogs in little baby carriers, or people carrying babies on their chests. I've also seen them in baby carriages. Have we gone too far, Jim?
Well, that's very hard to say. I mean, we've certainly shifted, so attitudes have changed. There's no doubt about it in recent decades, and people are being more and more, if you like, anthropomorphic about their animals, about their pets. But whether we've gone too far, I guess that has to be decided in terms of the effects on the animals, whether it's having a negative effect there and whether it's having a negative effect on the people.
Ah, interesting. Megan, let me go back to you. You have studied, or I guess maybe even worked with veterans and their military families and animals. Can you tell us a bit about some of your research?
Sure. So, yes, we looked at the role of pets in military families, particularly the effects on the kids in those families. And what we saw overwhelmingly was that the kids really relied on the animals as a source of emotional support, particularly when they were going through stressful situations, such as having a parent who is actively deployed or moving to a new location and therefore changing their school and maybe social groups. And they really had a lot to say about how their animals were friends for them and companions, and clearly helped them cope with some very difficult circumstances.
Meaning that they would just their very presence, or would they confide in them?
Right. So they talked a lot about emotional support, that the animal is my friend, keeps me company. When I don't have anyone to talk to, I can talk to my animal. So really a lot about that emotional attachment.
And Gail, I saw in sort of doing some research for this show, you know, a number of articles about how children do confide in the animals in their family, sometimes more than they might to a sibling or even maybe to a parent. Is it there sort of a non-judgmental presence in the family?
It is. It's non-judgmental. Also, I think there are a couple of other elements there. One is the fact that verbal skills are really not at a premium. If you can't express yourself clearly when you're distressed and upset to a parent or a teacher, another adult, you know, they'll stop you, use your words, they'll slow you down, they'll act puzzled, they'll put additional pressure. For children, they don't even need to say anything. So that whole challenge of expressing yourself verbally, I think, is gone. The second thing is the idea that if you confide in an animal, they can't tell anybody. They're not going to spill the beans. They're going to keep your secrets. Of course, children know if you really press them that the animal does not literally understand those words and doesn't literally, you know, keep your secret. But emotionally, they have the feeling that they've been understood, they've been heard, and those upsetting thoughts that they've poured out are going to be safe with that animal.
That's fascinating. How about the sort of the tactile, the touch part of having an animal? Jim, I'm looking at you.
Yeah, I think that's very important as well. Of course, it depends on the animal.
Sure.
And we know that children can have a deep bond and tell secrets to their fish. So that will, you know, not be the tactile channel. But many soft, furry creatures, from dogs and cats to gerbils, will provide a kind of contact comfort for children, a kind of wordless, soft touch that can be very comforting and stress-reducing.
Jim, you want to weigh in on that?
Yes. I mean, I think another thing about a dog is it may be perceived by a lot of children as a very safe presence, because dogs are sort of naturally protective animals. They will rush out and bark at threats and things like that. Even if they're not an aggressive animal, they may show that sort of territorial behavior. And for a child, and particularly a child who's in a stressful situation or is, you know, is missing a parent or something like that, having that safe presence there as somebody who likes being with them and shows this kind of protective behavior may be very reassuring, very comforting.
And something even about touching, let's say, a dog or something furry or fuzzy.
Yeah, it's a warm body, you know, it's and it likes being with you, you know.
Let me read some Facebook comments. This is from Keith talking about fish. He said, fish, my parents didn't trust that I would follow through on taking care of a cat and dog. So obviously he was allowed to have fish. Now I'm a cat owner. Hopefully we'll eventually have a dog as well. So sort of interesting introduction there. Lynette says cats and dogs. We had a robin that we raised after it fell out of the nest and a squirrel that we tamed by offering it raisins. And you're nodding your head, Jim, because it is, if you live with animals, there's a good chance that maybe a wild animal will become part of the family. When I was a kid, we had a raccoon for a year until we were told to we couldn't do that anymore. But nonetheless, we were the raccoon family.
Yeah. And many years ago, I did a study that clearly showed that kids who had lots of different types of pets seemed to have a much more stronger environmental conscience, if you want to call it that. And, you know, given the situation in this day and age with, you know, so many species going extinct, so many threats to the natural environment, the notion that this early exposure to animals, this, if you like, this ability to form all these relationships with different species could actually change your perspective on the natural world, to me, is very profound in significance, potentially.
Well, let me add to that, and let me get a response. This is Debbie from Facebook said, we grew up with all kinds of pets, dogs, cats, rabbits, hamsters, guinea pigs, finches, hermit crabs, etc. And she wrote, never a dull moment. But just picking up on what you just said there, Jim, about having a diverse assortment of animals connects you to the natural world.
It's a bit like, you know, having lots of exposure to people from foreign countries early in childhood. It may give you more a more global perspective.
Megan, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. I think what James said is spot on. It really helps kids learn how to situate themselves in the broader world and understand how their actions impact the environment and other animals in a really real way. And animals are a great hook for kids. They're very engaging. We talked about the biophilia idea earlier, that this sort of innate connection to animals and nature. And I think it's a great way for children to learn about their place in the broader world.
An email from Rebecca. I'll give this to you, Gail. She says, we have a 5-year-old boxer mix and a 2-year-old son. It's not always a Norman Rockwell painting, but seeing the two of them start to form a bond as my son grows is special beyond words. Without our dog, we wouldn't be a full family. I mean, it's a really nice story and a really nice picture as well. But I think the point she's making is that these relationships, like all relationships, take time to develop.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I think the research, mine and others, have shown right at the beginning is that pet ownership is less significant than pet attachment or relationship. So, you know, we can look at families and just get a demographic piece of information. Is there an animal living in that household or owned by that family, yes or no? And that really doesn't tell us too much about what the child's experience is, what the quality is for the family. But if we can delve a little deeper and we can look at what is actually the relationship, how did this develop, how not only just the species, the amount of time, but the more the quality of that relationship, we can begin to understand much more about its impact on the whole family. So simply just getting a pet or not having a pet, I think if families understand, that's not really as meaningful as really looking at what is the quality of the relationships that develop.
Jim, this is a whole other issue, but one thing that children learn by having an animal in their life is about death and dying. You know, a dog maybe lives 10 years, maybe a cat lives 12 or 15 years. So in many ways, children are going to outgrow the animals in their lives.
Yes, most children will outgrow their animals. And, it's an interesting question whether that's a positive experience or a negative one. I think, you know, increasingly our children are insulated from that aspect of the world, and maybe that's not surprising that we want to protect them from those kinds of things, but perhaps it is unnatural at some level, and that early exposure to death, even if it's a small death, if
sure.
you know what I mean,
sure.
a little animal, is probably an important learning experience and something that will maybe help children to cope with that experience later in life.
Megan, do you want to weigh in on that?
I agree. I think there are ways to make that a learning experience, learning about death as a natural part of the life cycle and allowing children to develop coping strategies for dealing with loss. And I think it could be a really important experience for development.
And Gail, about a minute before we have to say a break, do you want to weigh in on that as well?
Sure. Research suggests that 80% of children will experience their first idea of death with the death of an animal. So this is really reinforcing that this is kind of the first entry into what will be a very long history of coming to grips with mortality.
And I guess the importance of rituals and ways of remembering this animal, I mean, that can make a very painful experience, Gail, feel like it has meaning.
It can, but I would caution parents to really think about a child's developmental level. Very often parents will have an elaborate funeral and a burial in the backyard and this and that, and the child, as our experience was, is fidgeting and saying, "Can I go play now?" And it seems, they're so callous. But no, they're just not developmentally quite ready to grasp the full import of what death means. So I think these things are good, but parents should, I think, give kids lots of freedom in terms of understanding it in their own way and maybe coming back to that 6 months later when you least expect it, asking a question.
Well, another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about children and animals. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. If you're just joining us, we're talking about animals and children. And Gail Melson is a professor emerita of human development and family studies at Purdue University, wrote a book called Why the Wild Things Are, Animals in the Lives of Children. Megan Mueller, research assistant professor at Tufts University's Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine, also associate director of Tufts Institute for Human-Animal Interaction, both of them by telephone. And here with us in our Philadelphia studio, James Serple, professor of humane ethics and animal welfare, director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society at the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments or stories, you can join the conversation. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I can't read the screen here and talk, apparently, at the same time. Let me get an email from Janice, who says, having a child with a physical disability and allergies who grew up with a small dog, that was one of the best decisions as a parent I made. I feel that pets are natural therapy, animals, pure love. Megan, do you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. I think absolutely. Animals can be very therapeutic within the family setting. Certainly structured animal-assisted therapy is becoming much more popular, and there's a lot of great research coming out about that. For a lot of families, if it works within their family system and it's appropriate for them, animals in the family can certainly have a therapeutic effect.
And Jim, I was reading some articles about not for all children with autism, but for some children with autism, having an animal in the family can sort of help with communication and relationships. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. It's been actually quite an interesting study published recently that suggests that quite apart from the beneficial effect of having a dog in the household has on the child, it also dramatically reduces stress levels in the other family members. So typically parents who are dealing with an autistic child are pretty stressed, you know, because these children, the behavior is very stressful. And for some reason, having the dog there seems to calm everybody down substantially, which I think is very fascinating.
Gail, do you have any comments you want to add?
Yeah, I'd like to point out something else that I think is very beneficial for children with, particularly with visible disabilities. There's some good research that shows that an animal has a social lubrication effect. And by that I mean that a child with a disability, let's say in a wheelchair or impaired in other ways, gets much more friendly approach, talk, social interaction from others when with a animal. And this has been shown in research with dogs, but also children with a rabbit or a turtle or a gerbil, so it doesn't actually have to be a dog. And, you know, very often adults and children with disabilities can feel very isolated, especially when they're out in public places. People, unfortunately, sometimes avoid eye contact. They just go by. They don't really engage the person. And this, somehow, the presence of the animal serves as that social lubrication to start a conversation, to have somebody stop by and begin to talk to you.
Interesting. Let me get Skip from, looks like Spinnerstown, to join us on Radio Times. Skip, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Hi there. Sure.
Former English teacher, and I noticed for many, many years, I taught for 31 years in a public high school, and I noticed that my students who were horse owners were among the most responsible of all of them as far as getting homework on in time, doing what they were supposed to do when they were supposed to do it. Part of that thing was they had the responsibility of a horse. They had to be at a barn. They had to be mucking out stalls. They had to ride on certain time periods. And they just got responsibility very quickly. It was mostly girls, it turned out, only a few boys. But I noticed over the years that those kids and, oddly enough, farm kids were the two most responsible kids as far as you didn't have to push them or make them do the work. They were just on time, did what they were supposed to.
Well, Skip, I appreciate the call. And Megan Mueller, you are a horse person.
That's right. I that sounded very familiar to me. My parents always used to say that allowing me to have a horse was the best insurance policy they could have. So I can really empathize with that experience. I think it's definitely true. Horses have a very high level of responsibility that can be associated with their care. And, you know, I think it becomes a lifestyle for a lot of teenagers in particular. And caring for a horse is a pretty large investment in time. And there's also this sport aspect to it for a lot of kids. So they get a lot of the benefits of participating in a sport along with interacting with an animal. So I'm definitely a big fan of horses as a good activity for teenagers.
Skip, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Jim, he mentioned farm kids as well. And of course, growing up on a farm, I mean, these are not necessarily pets in the way we think about them in, you know, in non-farm households.
Yes, you have these very interesting phenomena of the 4-H kids who will spend, you know, enormous amounts of time caring for and feeding and grooming their particular farm animal, which will then go to an auction house and be sold off very often for meat, which I've always thought was a very difficult kind of transition, but maybe not. Maybe this is a way in which the kids can come to terms with the apparent paradox in that relationship.
In fact, Megan, you've done some of your research has been with kids in 4-H.
Yes, that's right. And what's really interesting is when you start looking at kids who have these relationships with more farm-type animals, is they often have very complex understanding of moral issues related to animals because they're experiencing these difficult decisions, difficult types of relationships that maybe you don't get with a companion animal that's living in the home. So I think it can be a really interesting experience for a lot of children.
Let me get Joan from, looks like, Egg Harbor Township in New Jersey to join us. Joan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you. I used to have two little dogs when I was 5 years old, and it was my first experience in school. And I used to, on weekends, I used to just sit my dogs up on my bed, and they were my pupils, and I used to teach them what I learned in school. And we used to sing together, and I had one dog that sort of made a little song or whatever. She used to sing along with me because, I don't know, she had like a whining thing. But it was so cute. I used to do the beat and teach them numbers and things, and they'd sit there and they'd look at me like they're trying to understand me. And I really enjoyed having two dogs.
It's a great story. And Gail, do you want to weigh in on that? I mean, I think,
that's a wonderful story and a wonderful example of this idea of the animal being this unconditionally accepting audience, that the kind of demands that are made by other human beings for reciprocity, you know, I talk and then I need to give you a turn to talk, or I help you and then you have to help me. All of that isn't there with an animal. I can, you know, have a tea party or play school or whatever it is, and the animal will fit in, you know, to that. And so this is, I think, a very kind of comforting thing for children as they're growing up.
Joan, thanks for the call. Yeah, Jim, you want to add something?
Well, I don't know about Joan, the caller, but very often we've found in studies, multiple studies actually now, is that the kids who get most out of this kind of experience are the ones who don't have any younger siblings. So it'd be only kids and kids who are at the bottom of the birth order in the family. And it looks like the animals are filling in the role of the missing younger sibling who can be taught and looked after and nurtured and cared for by the next child up the ladder, so to speak. So,
and sometimes dressed as well.
Dressed and, you know, very important.
Let me get to, looks like Christina from Gladwin to join us. Hi, Christina.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, my gosh. I have been sick my whole life with chronic ear infections. I've had 10 different surgeries, two of them experimental to try and hold my eardrum in place. And I never, ever would have gotten through them without my cat, Greta, and my dog, Daisy. Greta has been in my life since I was 5. Daisy came in when I was 10. Right around the time my first surgeon said to me, "You are going to be deaf by the time you are 16 if things don't change." And it's true what you guys say, that animals are so understanding and give you a place of comfort, especially when you have a physical disability. Because right when other people would call me these awful slurs, Greta and Daisy were right there by my side. Aww. Heck, when I started having surgeries and I was able to hear somewhat decently, Greta was high figured out the surgeries worked, because I never heard a cat purr until I had my first eardrum rebuilt. And then when that happened, I was like, "Mom, what's that noise Greta's making?" And she's like, "That's the cat purr."
Oh, that's great. Christina, I certainly appreciate the call to Radio Times. Gail, do you want to weigh in on that?
Oh, yeah. I think it's a great example of this sense of support and comfort that children can derive when they're under stress. And this is an example of really extreme stress of having very serious illness and surgeries. And, you know, Christina mentioned this idea of slurs from others. There was also some social rejection, other children really not understanding probably what she's going through. And through all of that, deriving that sense of comfort and support from her animals. So I think this is, you know, just a wonderful example of how important that can be for many children.
Christina, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me get Judy from Westchester to join us. Hi, Judy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Judy, and I was an only child adopted. And at 5, my parents brought in a dog named Rusty, and my mom had a serious and chronic mental illness that stayed with her throughout her life. And later in life, I was also diagnosed with a behavioral health challenge. Along with medication, my psychiatrist RX'd me a psychiatric service dog. So the dog that I had at that time underwent training, and we became interested in the psychiatric service dog organization, which has a great listserv. And the dog has been of such comfort to me throughout many, many decades, different dog.
That's a great story. And Jim, I'm looking at you. You're sitting across from me.
Yeah. I mean, it is a wonderful story and a very good illustration of what we've been talking about. And now we have this interesting explosion going on out there of what people are calling emotional support animals, mm-hmm. which are, you know, you can be prescribed an animal if you have a mental health problem of some kind, and then you have certain rights as a result of that. So
you can go certain places.
Certain transport will have to allow you. Your landlord has to allow you to keep the animal in the house or the apartment, that kind of thing.
I think it was you, Gail, wrote a bit about robotic pets. Are we sort of on the cusp of introducing robotic pets into our lives?
Well, yes, I've with some colleagues, we've been in recent years studying this phenomenon. And, of course, now with the Internet, there are virtual pets out there. And it's very fascinating to look at new technologies and to ask the question, is this the brave new world? Will they ever substitute for the warm, furry, living creatures that we've been talking about? In many places, and particularly in my trips to Japan, I've seen the use of various robotic pets in nursing homes, Alzheimer's units, children's hospitals. So these are being used in ways of providing comfort, stimulation, interaction already in many places. Our research suggests that they are a very imperfect and really not a substitute for the living animals. They may complement animals in situations in which other living things are not possible, but children and adults really do distinguish between the two, and they treat, for example, robotic pets not as machines, certainly not as living animals, but as sort of interesting new kinds of beings that are interactive and responsive, but clearly also machines in some way.
Well, we're almost out of time here. We haven't talked about stuffed animals. I'm going to put this to you, Jim.
Oh,
boy. But for, you know, for families or kids that just they're not going to have a living animal, stuffed animals can play a pretty important role.
Absolutely. I mean, I only have to look at my own daughter who still has her entire – I mean, she's 17 and her bedroom is still filled with stuffed animals in every corner. And most of them she's had since she was tiny. And if you even suggested getting rid of them, she would be outraged. So, yes, it's quite clear that at some level these are transitional objects. These are things that children have used since time immemorial to comfort themselves when there's no one around to offer them comfort.
Well, on that note, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times, talking about children and animals, two of my favorite subjects. James Serple, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Megan Mueller, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Gail Melson, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. In fact, to our listeners, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can carry on a Facebook conversation we started yesterday. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook and find us on Twitter as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show was produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens with Sophie Reed today. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.